Here's a job posting. Seeking someone for 24-hour, 7-day weekly shifts, providing meals, healthcare, housekeeping, transportation, entertainment, emotional and educational support for one or more clients. No paid vacation. In fact, no pay at all. Clients' needs will be met in full before worker will eat, sleep, bathe, or engage in any form of recreation. Minimum 18-year contract. Some obligations may extend for the rest of one's natural life. This seems like a really bad deal, right? But it's one we expect American parents, especially mothers, to take on without complaint. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's true that in the U.S., modern motherhood is a gig many of us are eager to volunteer for, and that it comes with a whole list of intangible rewards not mentioned above. But it's also true that our society has overlooked a lot of opportunities to make it easier, which we justify by convincing women that the only right way to do it is to be ready to sacrifice our own needs in favor of our families. Jessica Gross is an opinion writer at the New York Times, where she writes a newsletter as well, and she's got a new book out called Screaming on the Inside: The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Jessica, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your first taste of how systems could make this stuff easier or harder came when 2 days after starting a new job, the stick turned blue and you realized you were pregnant.
Correct. I proceeded to get extremely sick. I had hyperemesis, which is extreme morning sickness. And I like to joke that I leaned into a toilet because I was taking on a new opportunity at work and I just couldn't hack it. And I ended up quitting a couple months into that job just because there was not a situation in which I could really take a substantial amount of leave. I didn't know how long I was going to be sick for, if it would last for the whole pregnancy. And as privileged as I was then and am now, I still could not keep a job and have a family in that moment. And it was very sobering for me. I had reported on these topics before I became pregnant myself and obviously knew about the great inequities and the motherhood penalty at work. But it's one thing to report it and it's another thing to live it.
And at the time, it felt to you not like a failure of the system for being unable to support you, but like a personal failure. Somehow you came away from this with the sense that you were doing motherhood wrong before your child was even delivered.
Yes, that's correct. I think part of the insidious nature of the lack of a support system that we have for parents in America is that all the pressure comes on us individually. And we feel, instead of saying, you know what, I had no control over being sick. My job couldn't support me. That's not my fault. I put it all on myself. And part of the impetus for writing this book was to say to many parents, but especially mothers, a lot of things that you feel you did wrong are just cracks in the system that you fell through.
So I had the exact experience twice of getting pregnant right after starting a new job. But in both cases, my employers provided benefits, including, you know, maternity leave. Turns out, though, to be a matter even today of luck rather than public policy. What does the law mandate for full-time workers who become pregnant?
So your employer is not required to give you any paid leave at all. To qualify for family medical leave, which is the only federally mandated allowance that new parents get, it is unpaid. You have to have worked at a company for a full year to qualify for FMLA leave. And it is only 3 months, and your job is not guaranteed when you come back. And most people do not have fully funded paid leave through their employers, which is the only way to get it, unless you work for the federal government. The federal government does provide paid leave now. That was a Trump-era change for the better. So, most people are forced to make some really difficult decisions about their own wellness and their family's bottom line. And a lot of folks are returning to work before they physically really should be. And we are one of only two countries in the world. It's the United States and Papua New Guinea who do not provide any federally mandated paid leave to new parents.
So we continue to cultivate this idea that anything mothers can't get done is like an individual failure. Tell us a little bit about how American notions of the ideal mother looked during, say, colonial times.
So in colonial times, the ideal mother was a pious woman who sacrificed herself, worked all day, and the ultimate goal was saving her children's souls. The modern notion of parenting really didn't exist then. Kids were expected to work around the house as young as three. The second you could hold a broom, you were doing something around the colonial homestead. So there wasn't this idea that you were sort of consciously cultivating a child in the way that we expect parents to do today. And that notion of the ideal mother has really shifted over the past 200-300 years. But at its core, the idea that mothers should be self-sacrificing and put themselves last, that has been around for thousands of years and I think still continues today.
How did the shift in the U.S. economy from like household and homestead as primary workplace to market-driven work suddenly put childcare at the center of every mother's to-do list?
So this is an oversimplification of 100 years of history, but I'm going to do my best. When the Industrial Revolution happened, we started to see more of a division between the public and private spheres. So the public sphere was for men. Men went out to work. Women stayed home. Now, there were always women who worked, usually women of color, immigrant women, always worked throughout American history. But in general, we thought of the domestic sphere as where women were the head and they were not meant to go and be out in the public sphere. That really started to aggressively change in the 20th century. And World War II was a big moment where women were encouraged to have a life outside the domestic sphere. And they were working in factories to support the war effort. And they realized that overall enjoyed having the option to earn their own money and, you know, have careers and a space in public to raise their voices. And since then, we have been struggling to deal with the fact that the way American society has been structured expects one parent to be home at all times. Just something as simple as the fact that the school day doesn't match up with the work day creates a struggle and creates a break in between how people are living and what they need.
We should note one enormous and important exception to this was for enslaved Black mothers. Somehow they were not understood by their enslavers to even count as mothers of children.
Absolutely. They were separated from their children. They were treated terribly. And the legacy of their treatment sort of still remains, the residue of it remains with us today.
So in the 21st century in the United States, women are encouraged to have careers. That doesn't necessarily mean anything gets taken off their plates at home. Give us a rundown of what an ideal mother is supposed to be able to do in an average day in the 21st century.
So wake up at 5 a.m., exercise, meditate, get the kids off to school, go to work, be the perfect worker at work. They call it, the sociologists call it the ideal worker, which means you work as if you have no responsibilities at home. Come home, be fully present for your children, have a homemade organic dinner on the table for them, go to sleep at a reasonable hour, without watching hours of reality TV just to feel alive, and you know, wake up the next day to do it all again without complaint. That seems to be what we think of as the ideal.
You point out that the expectations we have for mothers today don't necessarily have anything to do with someone's relationship to her children, right? A lot of them are about kind of performing motherhood for our peers or for some broader audience online. What does that look like?
So I think we are all extremely conscious of parenting in public. I am thinking of this just because it ran last week in the New York Times, where I work, about people complaining about babies crying on airplanes, specifically first class passengers. And so we see all the time people complaining about babies just babying in public, and we are in a defensive crouch feeling guilty about our children's behavior when they are simply being normal children. And I think all of us are sort of deeply conscious of how our behavior is going to be judged if it is perceived to deviate from the norm. And obviously norms are different in different parts of the country and in different communities, but I think everyone is aware of potential criticism that may come your way. And when it's also projected online, I'm not the first to say what most of us are putting online is the highlights reel. And so even if we know intellectually that it's not real, and I think most of us know at this point that what people are putting on Instagram is not their reality, it still affects your brain. It still worms into it as a goal for all of us when it's not anybody's realistic life. So I think there's sort of two levels to it, where it's, you know, being out in public and having people have, you know, ideas about how you're parenting when they don't know you at all. And then there's sort of the projection and the performance of motherhood online, which many of us participate in at this point. And even if we're not putting something on the internet, we are ingesting a lot of internet and just so much information coming at us about how we should parent every day.
One thing that hasn't changed for centuries about the expectations for motherhood is that we automatically assume a level of self-sacrifice that, like, borders on self-flagellation. What are the consequences for a mother who puts her own needs ahead of her children's now and then, or even just appears to put her own needs ahead?
Well, you know, I mean, if you're doing it anywhere on the internet, just profound backlash and being told that you shouldn't have even been a parent in the first place. That's in sort of the public sphere. And in the private sphere, you know, just day-to-day judgment and sometimes even punishment and ostracization, depending on what kind of community you live in.
I was thinking about that. You know, like, if someone gets in a car accident, we hope that they're okay, and we're sad for them that their car got totaled and they have to buy a new one and it's expensive and inconvenient. We would never say to somebody, well, you signed up for a driver's license and you got out onto the street, so sorry about that.
So I think that there's a way in which if anything goes wrong with your health or your children's health, the first question is, well, what did you do? You must have done something wrong because it's all under your control. And that just couldn't be further from the truth in most circumstances. I wrote a story this summer about my kids having an eczema flare-up. And even though I've reported on all of these things for a decade, my lizard brain went directly to the idea, well, this must have been your fault. Did you switch their shampoo? Maybe it's because you didn't breastfeed long enough 9 years ago. You know, it was just immediately, how is this my fault? When, you know, maybe they just are genetically predisposed to eczema. And I think a lot of us have those ingrained ideas about ourselves and our children's health that I just would love to prevent.
Jessica, by late 19th, early 20th century, the U.S. had fully embraced what is sometimes called scientific motherhood. What did that term refer to?
So it referred to the idea that the latest child rearing techniques were based on the science of the day, and you had to stay up on them. And if you didn't, it was at your own peril. And what it was doing was often taking knowledge about motherhood and child rearing out of the hands of women and into the hands of male medical scientific quote unquote experts. And Some of their advances were definitely positive and we still use them today. And some of their ideas were incredibly damaging and still harm us today. So one thing I talk a lot about in the book was ideas about morning sickness that a lot of mid-century psychiatrists pushed. And there is an idea that if you didn't feel good during your pregnancy, you were conflicted about your own femininity and you had, you know, emotional problems with your father and you needed psychiatric help. When obviously today we know it's a biological function and it has nothing to do with your mental state or your emotional state. But those ideas were extremely pernicious and they remain with us today in some forms.
Scientific motherhood also coincided with the rise of this belief that children's mental and physical health were somehow fully under their mother's control and that something your mother did wrong could, in fact, you know, doom you to a serious illness later in life.
Yes. And so we saw, especially in the mid-century, moms being blamed if their children had autism or schizophrenia. And they would be both blamed if they were too cold. And so those mothers were called, quote unquote, refrigerator mothers. But you could also be blamed if you were too overbearing. And so there was a primrose path to walk that was completely impossible. And there were so many advertisements that I saw from sort of the 1920s to the 1970s that really tried to scare mothers into buying certain things. I remember one ad that was a Lysol ad, and it said, "Mothers, you are to blame," and implied if you did not have a hygienic home created by Lysol and something happened to your children, you would be in trouble. And I think sort of playing on mother's fears, especially in the early days of your child's life, is something that advertisers unfortunately still do today.
How have official government tallies accounted for the work of mothering as a form of labor?
Oh, they have not at all. We don't account for it. People have done back of the notebook calculations about what care, you know, unpaid caregiving adds to the GDP, but there's no official tally.
Wow. And for a shockingly long time, becoming pregnant could get you fired. And then ironically, being out of the workforce meant you were ineligible for employment compensation and you had a kid on the way.
Yes. So one thing that is actually quite heartening to me is how far we have come in just the past 50 years. So I think often about the fact that when my parents got married, my mother would not have been able to have her own credit card, that, you know, women were still regularly had to sign contracts when they took a job that said when they started showing with a pregnancy, they would quit or be fired. And so as much as it often feels like things feel depressingly static for American moms, we really have come such a long way in such a short period of time in terms of what society thinks we are allowed to do.
So we've now entered this era of what is called intensive mothering. Will you talk a little bit about what an intensive mother is expected to do?
So when you look at the statistics of the amount of time parents spend with their children, they've just absolutely skyrocketed in the past 40 years. So today, a working mom spends more hours a week with her children than a stay-at-home mom did in the 70s. And so intensive motherhood is just this idea that you have to spend the most amount of time with your children. You have to put them in the best classes, prepare them for college and jobs. And if you are not concertedly cultivating these super children, you have fallen short. Gone are the days of latchkey kids where, you know, you just let them play out in the playground without making sure they are in organized events that, you know, either encourage their brains or their bodies to do something productive. And so that is quite time consuming and effortful for everyone. So and a lot of money.
Yeah. How is it, Jessica, that a whole generation of parents who were raised with maybe less direct attention from their own parents feel the pressure to be parents in such a different way today?
Well, I mean, I think they are responding to very real economic pressures. Most of us, many parents who have young kids today came of age at times of increasing economic instability. So I've been thinking for a future project a lot about the fact that elder millennials and Gen X have lived through multiple recessions, political polarization. It's much harder to buy a home now than it used to be and set down roots. And I think they see realistically that their children may have a harder time staying in the middle class if they are already in the middle class or getting into the middle class if they are not. And so it is in some ways an understandable reaction to a feeling of profound instability geopolitically.
But on top of all of that, this kind of intensive mothering ethos really asks women to demonstrate at all times that they love every minute of what, let's face it, can be a pretty tedious and difficult job.
I think that's part of it too. I think there's also somewhat of a backlash into women having so much more power and success in the public sphere. And so there's always often a countervailing force that's saying, well, you still need to be 100% at home, and we are going to raise the standards at home just as we are, you know, allowing you to work. I say that tongue in cheek, because obviously I don't feel that way. But I think that that's also an element of it. It's like, well, we're allowing you to work, but you better not step off the gas at home for 1 second.
So you write about the fact that on top of the pressure to breastfeed, you felt pressured to really want to breastfeed and you didn't. Will you talk a little bit about having to kind of work through those feelings and what actually worked for your family?
Sure. So, you know, from the second I gave birth, there was a ton of pressure from the hospital to breastfeed my daughter. I really wanted to. I, you know, read all the studies. You know, I know that it's somewhat better if, you know, even at the time, I believed that formula was a perfectly good way to feed children. And I had also felt that because my pregnancy was so difficult, and I had sort of felt like I had failed at that, I really wanted to succeed at something else that was considered the gold standard for parenting a newborn. But the fact of the matter is it made me incredibly anxious. I never got the hang of it. I spent lots of money on a lactation consultant and was really driving myself pretty nuts to make something work that was really not working. And finally, the lactation consultant said, this shouldn't be about torturing you or your baby. And that was really magical to me. It felt like she had given me permission to stop doing something that clearly was not working for any of us. But also in retrospect, makes me very sad that I felt that I needed that permission because obviously caring for my daughter and her health was always of foremost importance to me, and that I ever doubted that her needs were, you know, being considered in this decision for my family just makes me pretty sad. And I think it's sort of when you look at the statistics about breastfeeding initiation in the United States, they reached a low point in the 70s and 80s. Only about 22% of American moms were initiating breastfeeding. And now over 80% of American moms start off breastfeeding their kids. And so I just think it's sort of sad that instead of being framed as, wow, that's an amazing public health success story, I feel like all we hear about is how we need to be doing more, despite the fact that we still don't have paid leave for all moms, and we make it incredibly hard for them to reach their breastfeeding goals. So I think we need to really be supporting moms and giving them a lot more credit for just doing their best in such an imperfect situation. I did not have paid parental leave when I made that decision. And I do think that that's an important thing to note, because I really wonder in retrospect if I would have had an easier time if I wasn't also so anxious about having to go back to work fairly soon.
How does the cult, Jessica, of total motherhood disadvantage mothers of color in particular in this country?
The whole idea of the ideal mother comes from a lot of racist beliefs about how people should behave and what mothers should be doing. And that idea always left out Black women, always left out immigrant women, and I think to this day still does. And I heard from so many women that I interviewed for the book that they felt incredibly alienated by ideas of what motherhood should look like that did not take into account their own cultures and their own backgrounds and their own experiences out in the world.
We should talk about fathers in all this because, I mean, they're not part of every family with children, but in many families, modern dads are eager and willing to take on the work of childcare. And yet, many mothers discover nobody expects this, right? So the default contact person for schools and doctors and daycare centers is the female parent, if there is one, even if both parents are listed on the contact sheet.
Yeah, even if you are trying to have a completely egalitarian marriage and you are able to succeed at that within the confines of your own home, there's a lot of education that you have to do of people outside your home, because you will always be, if you are the mother, you will usually be the one contacted for play dates. You will usually be the one that the school calls. And so there's a lot of extra work that goes into making society believe that the dad is an equal partner. And I also think that men suffer from these ideas as well, because often they want to be more involved. They want to spend more time with their children. They want to take all of their paternity leave, and they see that, especially at work, they will be punished for doing so. There are a lot of policies that appear to be flexible work policies, but on paper, but if they are actually taken by men, they are denied promotions, they're not given as good projects. So I think that there's ways in which these ideas really make it much harder for families to share the parenting load, even when they have the best of intentions.
One of the things you think could really help is more corporate leaders modeling what it looks like to take family leave.
Yes. I think that the only way people will think that they are not going to be punished for taking full advantage of family-friendly policies is to have that modeled from the top. Because if they don't see the people above them doing these things, they are going to think that they will be denied promotion, punished in some way, thought less of to do these things. So all of these things need to be modeled from the top.
Yeah, you argue here that some amount of paid leave for caretaking ought to be part of everyone's employment contract, not just mothers. What are some of the reasons you think why the U.S. has lagged behind so many other countries in providing this to all workers? How do our employers get away with it?
Well, I mean, I think that the problem is that most of these benefits in our peer nation have much more government support. So often it's not the employer's fault that they can't afford to do these things, because they're not getting subsidized by the government to do them. And so it makes sense that, you know, many will not give those things to workers. I mean, I hear all the time from people who work for multinational corporations, and the benefits that people who work in offices in Germany are wildly different than the benefits that the workers in the U.S. get. And so I think we just need much more federal support of families in a myriad ways that isn't happening.
Do you see conversations happening? Are you noticing people talking about this, which would indicate it's on the way?
I am very optimistic that paid leave will happen in my lifetime at the federal level, just because even in the editing of this book, which took 2 years of writing and editing, two more states passed paid leave laws. So it was Delaware and Maryland. So we see incremental move forward. Paid leave is incredibly popular. I mean, I saw one poll in Politico that suggested that 95% of Americans support the notion. And that's obviously regardless of political affiliation. And, you know, I talked to Republicans who are very supportive of these sorts of family policies and understand that it's just inhumane to ask a mother to go back to work through, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after having given birth. I mean, that's just a terrible idea for so many reasons. And so I think that I'm very optimistic that that will happen. And I think that especially since the early days of COVID in 2020, many, many more people are seeing that we need these kinds of policies just to make America continue to function.
Jessica, you have written from time to time about your struggles with mental health. And rather than empathy, you've sometimes been like blasted by people who argue people with mental health challenges don't deserve to have kids. I know you realize that's nonsense and it's also an impossible goal, even if we agreed it should be so. But there's no way that that couldn't have hurt you, right?
I think it probably did at some point. But I think now in year 10 of writing about these issues, I have developed such a thick skin that nobody can say anything that hurts me. I don't know if that's good or bad. I think that there is just such value at the end of the day about being honest about these things, that any sort of criticism from people who don't know me or don't care about me just doesn't impact me in the same way it used to. I mean, is it fun? No, I don't enjoy it, but it doesn't hurt me in a way that I think it used to earlier in my motherhood journey. And I also think I wouldn't still be writing about it if that sort of criticism, which I think is so easy to dismiss out of pocket, still really bothered me.
So I understand that the whole point of this book is changing the culture, changing and improving structural support for mothers and families, rather than mothers changing themselves. That said, I wonder if there are things you've learned about putting yourself in the firing line of people who, you know, choose to judge you because you've been so candid about your own life. If there's anything you could pass on to people who just wish they could stop listening to all the nonsense and have confidence in their own abilities as parents?
Well, so the first thing is, if social media is making you feel bad, set better boundaries around it. And that's advice I could give myself. There are often days I have terrible feelings looking at social media, and I still look at it because it is very addictive. But I think, you know, we're all adults. We need to set better boundaries for ourselves and notice our feelings. And when things are making us feel bad, just step away, take a step back, unfollow, mute, do whatever you need to do. I think that's one thing. I think another thing that has been helpful to me as I do my reporting is anytime I feel guilt or shame about something related to parenting, I pause, because those feelings are unavoidable. You have to feel your feelings. They're going to come up. And I say, is this thing that I feel bad about, does it matter in my relationship with my own children, not some mythical ideal children, my own children, my own family, or is it something thing that helps my community? And if it is neither of those things, it is much easier for me to put that feeling of guilt away. So an example I often give is my older daughter, when she was younger, was giving me a hard time for not hand making her Halloween costume. And I was like, first of all, you don't want this. If I handmade this costume, it would look terrible and you would be sad. But secondly, you know, it's just, I felt bad because, you know, it was like her being jealous of her friend who had this amazing handmade costume. And I was like, this is not for me. I'm never going to be able to do this. This doesn't make me a bad or uncaring mom. It's just something I'm not able to do. And that's totally fine. There are just things you're not going to be able to do, you're not going to want to do. Do I think that that harmed my daughter in the long run? No, she is fine. We are all fine. And it did, I mean, it actually led to something kind of beautiful. Her best friend's mom, who had made this costume, helped her with some sewing lessons, which was so cute because I was like, well, let's teach you how to sew. If you're interested in this, we can make this happen for you. So I think there's so many ways in which there are just so many expectations coming at us about what we should do at every turn. And to be able to figure out which parts of those things are actually important to us, that's really affirming to understand what your own values are and what's important to you and your family.
How did COVID make it impossible to maintain the belief that a good mother could fulfill all her obligations without any structural support?
Oh, I mean, schooling was the biggest one, I think, for many of us. I mean, I could not even, my older daughter's in second grade at the time, and I was just reflecting how I could not even teach her math for one day. I tried my best, man. We tried so hard that spring, and it just was not possible. It was not possible to do all of the things in a single moment. I think it was the expectations that are usually floating around us in the ether that we don't maybe even recognize. It was all of that on steroids all at the same time. So I think a lot about this one moment. And I talk a lot about this one moment where it was the summer of 2020. I was putting laundry from the washer to the dryer. I had a conference call in my ears on mute. So I was trying to work. And then my kids were yelling in the background because they were hungry. And it was lunchtime, and I needed to make them lunch. And I just felt that all in that minute, and it was completely unmanageable. And no one could do all of those things in a single minute. That is not possible for a human being to do. And so I think everybody realized that this collection of expectations, even in when it was more spread out in the non-quarantine days, maybe were not reasonable to ask of any one human being.
I thought so much during the collapse of the kind of daycare system. It's not really a system, but the collapse of a lot of daycare availability in this country during the early days of COVID, because I spent the early years of my children's lives as a single parent, and there would have been no way with like a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old for me to both work full time and provide daycare. It just wasn't possible. And we expected families to do this over and over, like it wasn't such a big deal.
Absolutely. And I think we're still seeing the fallout. And hopefully it will create some change. I mean, the last statistics I saw, we're still down about 80,000 workers in the childcare sector since 2019. And I think you're seeing organizations like the Chamber of Commerce getting involved in childcare lobbying because they see that the economy cannot function if parents can't go to work. And so I don't think that that's a good thing. I'm not happy to see so many people still not be able to, make ends meet because they don't have adequate childcare that they feel safe with. But if the silver lining is that more people are aware of this as a huge issue, that affects so many people and mothers in particular. And as you say, single mothers the most, I'll take that silver lining, even though I do not wish that this dysfunction continued.
How are states starting to take up the problem of supporting families or the challenge of supporting families to fill the gaps left by federal policy?
So, like I said, there's more and more states that are putting forth paid leave bills and passing paid leave bills. We see basically every year for the past, since I want to say 2016, we've seen more and more states pass paid leave. So that is really great. Recently, New Mexico passed a child care bill that would help pay child care providers more. Washington, D.C. passed such a bill, I think, last year. So we're seeing it in bits and pieces. And I do think more and more conversations are happening. For now, I think there needs to be more action and follow through based on these conversations, but all of this often takes time. I mean, I interviewed some of the folks who worked on the New Mexico bill that provided child care workers with more funding, and it took them 10 years. So the legislative process is often quite a long one. And so talking is absolutely the beginning of it, but I would like to see faster action because, you know, there's more people and new people with young children every year. And people often, when I get negative feedback, people often are like, well, I don't want to pay for your kids. And I'm like, I've already aged out of this. You're not paying for my kids. I want to pay for other people's kids because we should make this easier for the new parents that are being minted every day. We make it too hard for them. And I think part of the reason we might not have these things as a country is because when people move out of that immediate period of need, they're too tired to keep fighting. It is going to be a years-long fight.
Yeah, it is interesting that we still, even if we've had the experience of ourselves of how hard it is, when we hear parents asking for some help to do a good job in raising their kids, whether that's, you know, help with childcare or economic support, we look at them like they're trying to get away with something.
Yes, and that is profoundly depressing to me. I would want to make life easier for parents. And I think we should all feel that way because it's not just, if you're wanting to look at it in a completely self-interested way, it's just better for society when parents are not as stressed and when they feel like they have more support and they are able to make ends meet easier because then they can be there for their children. And it's really, we're talking about raising the next generation of Americans. And I just don't think that what could be more important?
Maybe there's a certain level of like maternal selfishness that we could all agree is too much. But is there a way we could change the culture around this so that we don't only praise the mothers who, you know, are only sleeping 4 hours a night so that they can do everything for their families and never have time for themselves?
So I think a lot about cross-national comparisons. Because I think there's often a sense that, well, it's always been this way and it's always going to be like this and it can't be different. But a sociologist named Caitlin Collins interviewed a bunch of moms from different countries for a book that she wrote a few years ago. And a Swedish mother told her that her idea of being a good mother was just spending time with her kids. And if that was just the bar, just spending nice quality time with your children. That's it. If that could just be our bar, that's something I think about a lot. I think that should be the bar, not all of these other things that may or may not affect anything at all in terms of our relationships with our children or our communities. So managing our expectations and our desires, I think, would be really important.
How much do you think men, whether fathers or maybe prospective fathers, are tuned in to this conversation?
It's really all over the place. I think many are. I think more are. More and more are every year. I think often because as society keeps going, more and more men were raised by women who worked. And who hopefully talked to them about these challenges and wanted them to be more involved in their own children's lives. And I think we also just see more people in their 20s and 30s talking about desiring work-life balance and that's a priority for them. And I think more men are talking about that. So I think I would say more than before, but obviously still not the majority, I guess I would say, but it's a squishy thing that's hard to put an exact number on.
We can't blame them for this, but being a child by nature sort of makes one feel like the center of the universe and like all these services ought to be just provided for them. And, you know, there are certain basic things obviously parents need to do for their kids. But do parents need to have conversations with their children about the fact that, you know, mom is a resource that can be depleted and sometimes they might have to wait or they might not get something they want from a parent?
Oh my, absolutely, all the time. I think I often tell my kids, I need a break. Not a break from you, not you're annoying me, but mom just needs some alone time. Everybody needs alone time. You need alone time. They're welcome to go to their rooms and have some alone time because that's just what humans need sometimes. So we talk a lot in my house about, you know what? I just need a break right now. You need to entertain yourselves. Parents do not need to entertain their children all of the time. They can be bored. They can enter. I mean, obviously, not all children have siblings, but they can entertain each other. You can read a book. We constantly talk in my house, and I think it's really important to be transparent with your kids. I think showing your kids that your labor matters, whatever that labor is, because it's all labor, right? I think having really transparent conversations with your kids about that is really important.
Jessica Gross is an opinion writer at the New York Times and writes a newsletter there. Her new book is called Screaming on the Inside: The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Jessica, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast wherever you get yours. Just again, search for KERA Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.